Welcome to The Rhetoric, your home for culture, politics, and religion. I'm your host, Jerry Jacques. On today's show, we'll first talk about Trump's withdrawal of the United States from the UN's Human Rights Council and implications. Second, as promised, some more introductory conversation on the Book of Revelation. The Rhetoric starts now. Trump, the United Nations Human Rights Council, and what does it mean? An article published on June 19 in the New York Times reports that the Trump administration ordered the withdrawal of the United States from the UN's Human Rights Council. Let's just call it HRC from here on after. The author, Gardner Harris, states that the withdrawal was due to HRC's, and I quote, frequent criticism of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. The HRC, which birthed in 2006, doesn't include Trump friendlies such as Russia, who was booted in 2016 for crimes in Syria, nor does it include Israel, who called the council, according to the Times of Israel, a biased, hostile, anti-Israel organization that has betrayed its mission of protecting human rights. What we end up with is Trump walking away from a council that stood against two nations he has acted very favorably towards. The UNHRC, located in Geneva, Switzerland, was established by the UN General Assembly on March 15, 2006, to replace the then UN Commission on Human Rights that had been criticized for allowing countries with poor human rights records to be members. The mission of the UNHRC, according to its website, is to promote and protect human rights around the globe and for addressing situations of human rights violations and make recommendations on them. It has the ability to discuss all thematic human rights issues and situations that require its attention throughout the year. Now, allow me to make a point. If you dig enough in the operations of any institution, you will find things that are displeasing, areas where they have failed to live up to what they ought to be. What I'm saying by bringing this up is that if you want to remove yourself from any group or organization, you can do so because there is always something to complain about, and we like to find things to complain about. However, since no substantial accusations are currently on the table against HRC, our assessment of the American departure, or I should say Trump's willingness to leave, should be based on whether HRC is right in the claims it makes concerning the situation with Israel and the Palestinians. The manner with which Israel has dealt with the Palestinians has not always been humane. From a good deal of those outside of the region looking in, and even from those who have had extensive experiences on the ground to have a look at the situation, Israel has been seen as being very heavy-handed, abusive, and downright barbaric. Before mentioning what HRC accused Israel of, let's first discuss a precursor in 2017. So I'm going to try to line things up in sort of like a chronological order from 2017 and then earlier on this year. So first with June 2017, and this institution is called Human Rights Watch and their statement on Israel. Let's travel back in time to June 2017. On June 4th, Human Rights Watch, HRW, posted an article entitled, Israel, 50 years of occupation abuses. Now, in case you are wondering on the impartiality of HRW, let's consider its leadership. The executive director is Kenneth Roth. Mr. Roth's father escaped Nazi Germany and educated his son of what it was like during Hitler's reign of terror. If anybody is concerned on a fair analysis of Israel's conduct, a person with such a background, for the most part, will not come in question. You know, his father gave him the whole story, so he should be, out of everybody else, a fair person to Israel. So this institution that he's the executive director of, HRW, Human Rights Watch, stated that Israel, and I quote, controls these areas, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, through repression, institutionalized discrimination, and systematic abuses of Palestinians. HRW went on to say that Israel violated at least five categories of major violations of international human rights law and humanitarian law. And it's listed these categories as being unlawful killings, forced displacement, abusive detention, the closure of the Gaza Strip and other unjustified restrictions on movement, and the development of settlements along with the accompanying discriminatory policies. Let's go back now to earlier this year. Point number two, United Nations Human Rights Statement on Israel. Fast forward to earlier this year, the UNHRC stated that Israel breached Article 147 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore a war crime. In writing on this, the Jerusalem Post didn't fail to mention that Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, is a Jordanian prince, which in a way, by mentioning this, opened the door for some to speculate that the decision is based on a bias towards Israel. This is why I had to refer to Roth's background in order to show that these were from two different sources speaking on Israel, and one of them happened to be executive director that is a Jew. So back to this, the Human Rights Watch. The Jerusalem Post goes on to mention how five reports surfaced against Israel as opposed to only a single report each on human rights issues in countries such as Syria and Iran. Despite the possibility of al-Hussein's bias towards Israel, Penal Section 2 reads, grave breaches to which the preceding article, the violation, 147 violation, relates, shall be those involving any of the following acts. Now listen carefully. If committed against persons or property protected by the present convention. Here goes. Willful killing, torture or inhuman treatment, including biological experiments, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, unlawful deportation or transfer or unlawful confinement of a protected person, compelling a protected person to serve in the forces of a hostile power, or willfully depriving a protected person of the rights of fair and regular trial prescribed in present convention, taking of hostages and extensive destruction and appropriation of property, not justified by military necessity and carried out unlawfully and wantonly. All of the aforementioned constitute a violation of Article 147. There is no question that Israel is culpable in these violations. It should be obvious that this correlates well with what the Human Rights Watch stated in 2017. So you have a report in 2017 seeing the same thing as what you find earlier from two different independent sources. Let's move on. What are the implications? What does this all mean? How do all these things add up? America's close tie with Israel stems in part from many factors, but especially with the Zionistic perspective, where on one hand you have attempts by revisionist historians to deny the historical factuality of the Holocaust. On the other hand, there exists a group that holds Israel of the most highest regard, in whose eyes it can't do no wrong, because they believe, this particular group believes, that God has made them the city on a hill. The Christian Bible is used to undergird their point of view. Now, Obama, during his presidency, didn't seem to care too much for this perspective and didn't shelter Israel from accusations in the UN, hence the falling out with Netanyahu. Trump, for whatever reason, perhaps as another counter to Obama presidency, opted to disregard the usual U.S. allies and align himself with those that adhere to much more aggressive approaches to conflict resolution. One can't help but wonder if his shenanigans at the G7, if his chumming up to Putin and requesting that Russia returns to the G8, are all simply to reverse, counter, and be as different from the Obama presidency as possible. If that is the case, if this is what Trump's ultimate goal is, he's doing a good job. He's succeeding at it. The news of the American withdrawal from the UNHRC is not spoken as much in the American public square. The reason being is that most of the attention was being given to the story to the South, at the border where children were being separated from their parents and placed in cages like wild animals. A tangible, very real reality of what Trump thinks of non-white immigration. With the role of the UNHRC being to point out human rights violations committed by the nations in the UN, including the United States, the U.S. treatment of children may present a conflict of interest if they are sitting in a body that can bring into question how they are choosing to carry out their immigration policy. Hence, Trump may not see it necessary to be part of a council that will disagree with how he operates. Now, I'm not saying that I think the reason Trump pulled out of the UNHRC is because of the loud cry against child imprisonment, but I find it odd that he chose to do so at this time. Whether he factored it in or not, it's irrelevant at this point, because he very reluctantly signed an executive order keeping most families together. Now, one thing I can be certain of is how he would try as much as possible to place himself in a position to not be answerable to anyone. And this is where we get to the heart of what does this mean. Trump doesn't want to be answerable to anyone. In other words, in his view, the UNHRC may simply be endowed with too much oversight. He barely listens to his own advisors, and with his posturing of America not being too interrelated with the rest of the world, it may actually be great restraint on his part that we are still part of the United Nations. Trump is controlling himself. Trump wants to answer to no one. He wants to function, and he alluded to this, like the Kim Jongs of the world, to be highly favored, to be beloved, unchallenged no matter what, to be high and lifted up. He seems to have a fascination with dictatorial power and wants to find any way to have that power be effective in his administration. This managerial style is always in full display. The war on non-white immigration is so intense that children are not seen as having any worth. While scripture was being quoted to justify inhumane methodology, children, of whom the Bible speaks of as having been killed by during the births of both Moses and Christ, were, and probably still are, experiencing emotional and psychological trauma from which they may never recover, of such magnitude that we could probably never discover. It is a degrading, dehumanizing experience to find yourself in a cage as a grown man or woman, let alone children. But the question still remains, why pull out of the UNHRC? Whatever reason Trump has up his sleeve, we can be certain that America shouldn't be there. America can't be part of a body discussing human rights violations committed by nations when its president was brought kicking and screaming to sign an order against child imprisonment. But at least consider this point, these points. Trump has issues with the G7, with the UNHRC. He praises Putin and praises Kim Jong. These four, in a nutshell, give you a vision of his MAGA, Make America Great Again mission. An empire requires an emperor, doesn't it? The Book of Revelation, should you read it? The Book of Revelation is not something that I hear much from most of the young Christians or even the adults that I know. The few that voice opinions on occasion are most interested in making historical connections. While it is a prophetic book, which does require those connections at some point, I've been wondering lately, as John Pauline, the Dean of School of Religion at Loma Linda University, states, do we get so absorbed in history that we fail to follow the story of Revelation itself? This, he goes on, may cause us to miss things that are important in helping us understand the text itself and how it helps us understand history. In the spirit of the statement, I've begun walking through Revelation again. I came down this road several times before when I first read Revelation. I was driven to seek to make connections so I can defend my traditional position. Over the years, as my understanding of biblical interpretation, due to constant reading and some theological classes, as my understanding deepened, I started to notice things I didn't see before. That is not to say that I've deterred from my perspectives on prophecy and eschatology. And eschatology is just simply meaning study of last things. That doesn't mean my perspective has changed much. Rather, my understanding has been strengthened. This time around, I don't want to bog you down by starting with background information or theological terminology. The reason, most people are more interested in devotional messages than the process that one goes through in order to develop the material for their devotions. That being said, I began with reflection on the first three verses, which some Bibles call introduction and benediction. It tells us, one, where Revelation comes from, two, the beings involved, the entities involved in the process to get it to earth, and three, why we should read it. Let's begin with the origin of Revelation. Where does the content of Revelation come from? The value that we put on Revelation is based on a claim that it makes concerning itself. It originated from God, according to Revelation 1:1. In fact, all of the versions I've read explicitly says God gave. Thus, there is no confusion about the origin of the content that is within this document. However, curiosity should prompt one to ask, what does it mean when it says God? This question arose because I noticed that a difference is made in the verse, in the text, between Jesus Christ and God. As one who believes in the Trinity, I thought that if God gave the revelation to Jesus Christ, then the term God must be referring to God the Father, God the Spirit, or both? Is it referring to the Father? Well, how would you go about proving it? Now, this is not to say that the Spirit wasn't aware of the transfer of the communication or what may have you, and I hope I did not perplex you further concerning this already perplexing book. The point is that God is the source. This is the divine origin of the book. I thought that it would be necessary to mention the human writer in this origin section also. John, a writer with four other literary documents in the Bible, is the human being that was, as the Apostle Peter puts it, moved by God, 2 Peter 1, verse 21. This is an example of Peter's words in action. Part 2, this journey from God to earth. John could have started the revelation by simply stating it was given to him by God, but he didn't. Instead, he decided to list four beings: Jesus, God, an angel, and himself. As stated earlier, it begins with God. Revelation unveils a God who took the initiative of sending something that wasn't asked. And we came to understand that any revelation from God must be seen as valuable. Thus, God gave it to Jesus, who then gave it to an angel. The Godhead gave an angel the opportunity to participate in the transmission of this communication. This adds to the greatness of the revelation. Heaven embarked on a great mission to bring something to earth. This mission involved all the big names. The angel enters into the world of mankind and gives the prophet the secret that is to be unveiled. Finally, part 3, why bother with this book? This may seem like a stupid question, but it is one that I've heard frequently. Before discussing the reasons, as stated in the first three verses, I would like to present an analysis of the contemporary climate. People are more interested in reading the stories in the Bible that they can easily understand. I reckon that the reason for this, that is to say, for those that are serious, is to find commands and principles that will tell them what to do. This is a good objective because the Bible does provide guidance. The problem is that in the quest to find what to do, some people develop a habit of being content with the quickest answer. Anything that challenges the mind to dig deeper receives a screwed face. Other than the fact that it is in the Bible, which I have noticed, it's not a motivator for Christians to read something anymore. Revelation states that its readers, hearers, and doers will be blessed, according to verse 3, as I mentioned in the Lad podcast. If this is not an incentive to invest time into this book, then I don't know what is. I don't know what will get you to do it. There is a strong focus on sermons about God's blessing in the larger Christian community. A large number of time, these blessings are only referring to finances and our relationships. And yes, God can bless in those areas. But here is an opportunity to be blessed, and all you have to do is prayerfully read. There is something to note about this blessing that is being promised. The verse says that blessings will come upon the one who reads and those who hear it and take it to heart. An idea that may come to the mind of someone reading this is that there are two prerequisites for this blessing. The first is that if you are a reader of Revelation, then you will be blessed. The condition is that you simply read it. The second is that a blessing is reserved for those who don't read it but heard it. The listeners, they reckon, also have to practice the counsels within. Jacques B. Ducamp, professor of Hebrew and Old Testament exegesis at Andrews Theological Seminary, comments that this section of the three verses is a reference to the worship service in which Revelation is to be read. He bases this on the fact that the one who is reading it is stated in singular form and the hearers are in the plural. So does this mean that we only receive the blessing if we gather somewhere and hear someone speak on Revelation? No. Without going into too much of a discussion on meaning of words, Dukan states that the word that is being used in reference to hearing also requires the understanding of what is being heard. This will require more than just sitting in church or any other setting and hearing a sermon or a discussion of the book. You actually have to go and try to understand it. What about Jesus? Any discussion on Revelation must include Jesus. Not only did he participate in the transmission process of the material, but it is also a revelation about himself. And perhaps the real issue with understanding this is due to the failure of some to show the church how Jesus is revealed. Jesus' relationship to the rest of the book is pivotal in understanding it, since it's a revelation of him. Another reason that must come in under this section is Revelation's claim to contain what must soon take place. This is repeated both in verse 1 and verse 3. I'm sure that what will happen tomorrow, or even for the rest of today, for that matter, is of great interest to many. Well, God doesn't give us all the information about what is going to happen soon, but he does give us something. The only reason why we would deny ourselves this information is if we don't believe that it is really there. Our belief in whether or not this document contains what it says it does will affect whether we read it or not. Here is your recommended reading. The book is called I Am Malala, The Girl Who Stood Up for Education and Was Shot by the Taliban. It's written by Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai with Christina Lamb. The book takes you to Pakistan, and not only does it show the philosophical clashes of various perspectives on the interpretation of Islam at the village level, but it also gives you a sense of what day-to-day childhood looked like. It's a good read. You can find both articles at rhetor.com. That's R-E-T-H-O-R.com. This has been The Rhetoric.